Welcome to the podcast, everyone. So today we're going to continue our journey down the Bhagavad Gita. And this is going to be a continuing theme. So one thing we're going to do is go back to the Bhagavad Gita and kind of unpack the chapters and see what it has to say about yoga. So we left off in chapter one. And chapter one, it's basically setting the stage for what's happening. We have Arjuna, who's our protagonist, and he's on a battlefield with Krishna, who is his good friend and cousin. And the battle that they're facing, they're looking out and they're seeing family members, their cousin. And in this way, there's been events that happened that led this up to this point where they're going to do battle. Basically, you have evil personified on the other side. But mixed in with that, because of political reasons, there's people who Arjuna loves on the other side. So on the other side, you have family members, martial arts teachers, teachers, uncles, grandfathers. It's like he sees people who he genuinely cares for and loves. So in that way, he balks, right? And if he doesn't do anything, then evil wins, right? And then you could say that then they would take over and it would be even worse. But in reality, something very disrespectful happened to people who Arjuna and his side of the family really loves. And if they did nothing, then evil would persist. So he's put in a very difficult situation. So he basically goes through his panic attack, loses it, says he doesn't want to fight. And here he is, a warrior. He was not just any old warrior. He was the elite of the elite. I always equate him to a Navy SEAL. One thing that they do is they line them up on the beach. It's very cold. The Pacific Ocean is very cold. And they line them up on the beach and they say this thing. They look out. And the instructor is just having them, they sit linked, locked arms. And they're sitting there and the water is just hitting them. And they're freezing and they're tired. And the instructor is looking out. And he asks them, he says, "Do you know what I'm looking for?" And none of them answer. And he says, "I'm looking for a war." And it's so intense to think like that, because most people are like, even most people who join the military aren't necessarily going out looking for war. But somebody who is trained in this elite way, it's actually for them. Some of the Navy SEALs in the 90s, they talk about it, that it was peacetime. And they didn't really have that outlet, but they were trained and they were waiting for it. So here you have somebody of that caliber who has been trained since he's very young and he's very good at it. And then here it is, the war. He gets to avenge this very disrespectful thing that was done to his wife. And then he sees his family members and he freezes and he has a panic attack. So chapter one is really about that. But the philosophy, and yoga is not mentioned, right? So the philosophy and the spiritual teachings start in chapter two. So one of my teachers, Tukaram, he always advises people. He says, don't start with chapter one. He said, go to two. Because chapter one will just confuse you. He always says that when he started reading the Gita, he was getting frustrated because he couldn't get past chapter one because you're learning all these weird names. And these names only make relevant once you start to read the Mahabharata, which is the book that the Bhagavad Gita is a a book of. So you have a book within a book. So the Bhagavad Gita is a book within the bigger book of the Mahabharata. So, chapter 2, the philosophy really starts at 2:12. So he says, never was there a time I did not exist, nor you, nor all these lords of men, meaning kings. And neither will there be a time when we shall cease to be. This is a powerful statement. So, never was there a time it did not exist. So he says, not veva hum jatu nasam. Not veva hum jatu nasam. So the not and the na, they're negating words in Sanskrit. So, not veva hum jatu nasam. Right? Never was there a time I did not exist. That statement alone, this is the opening gambit. This is the opening teaching of the Bhagavad Gita. The opening philosophy. I mean, you can say that in 2:11, he's also kind of alluding to this too. But I always like to start with 2:12. It kind of brings it all together. But never was there a time that I did not exist. So what's he talking about? He's talking about reincarnation. So when you talk about reincarnation, it means that you've come back many times. You're in something called samsara. So samsara is you're on a wheel, basically. And it's almost like being on a Ferris wheel and you can't get off. And you're continually coming, and maybe you get off of your cart, whatever that you're in, the piece of the ride, right? But then you have to get right back on. And when you get right, you maybe get on another one. It's a little different. But you're on this wheel, and it's hard to get off. So never was there a time I did not exist. And then he goes a little further. He says, nor me, nor all these kings, and nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. So he's saying that the soul is eternal. So the soul is eternal. One thing that attracts me to bhakti and the Bhagavad Gita and yoga, it has a very fleshed out version of giving you what the soul is compared to some other religions that I've been exposed to. I find that the depth in which they go to describe the soul, it satisfies my curiosity, because it's always like, what does that mean? I don't know. Like, that's a question that I ask about most things. Like, why? What does that mean? Like, that's my next obvious question. So somebody tells me to do something, and in my head I go, why? I wonder why that is. Not in like a disrespectful way, but just in a general way. Why? So he's describing this concept in yoga called Sankhya. And Sankhya is the difference between spirit and matter. And then yoga is the execution of Sankhya. So Sankhya and yoga, they go together very, they're like brother-sister as far as philosophy goes. So once you understand the difference between spirit and matter, that's Sankhya. But then how to apply that in your life, in the world, that's yoga. In the Gita, Krishna says yoga is skill in action. It's skill in your karma. I always find that just a brilliant definition of yoga. Skill in action. So skill within my karma. That's a proper definition of yoga from the Gita. So back to the book, 2:13. Just as in the body, childhood, adult, old age, happy to be an embodied being. So also The embodied being acquires another body at the time of death. The wise one is not deluded about this. So I'm reading a translation from Winthrop Sargent. And there's other translations of the Gita. And some translations of the Gita are, they're not all created equal. Winthrop Sargent's translation of the Gita is, I think it's awesome. I think it's a profound work. It's a clean, that's a horrible sound. Let's see here, what just happened? So, I'm going to go back. Sorry, I just had a technical difficulty there. I'm going to go back to this. So, 2:13. This, again, is the Winthrop Sargent translation of Gita, because it's the one I have in front of me, and it's a respected one. I asked my teacher, Tukaram, besides the Gita as it is by Prabhupada, which Gita translation do you recommend? And he said the Winthrop Sargent one. So he says, just as in boyhood, youth, just as the soul passes through boyhood, youth, old age, and you could replace that with girlhood, obviously, adulthood, the embodied being also travels to another body at the time of death, and a wise soul is not bewildered by such a change. So in this way, he's basically saying, just as we go through life and we experience different types of experiences in our bodies, you're going to die, and then you're going to go to another type of body at the time of death. Which, I saw this thing with Wayne Dyer once. And he basically took this very concept. Wayne Dyer had a brilliant way of taking esoteric concepts and making them very palatable for the Westerner, including myself. And he posted pictures of himself in this lecture, and it was him as a young boy, a baby, and then a toddler, and then a teenager, and an adult, and he said, oh, look at this body that I had, and he was like very muscular at the time, and then he said, oh, look at that body, and then he had obviously gained some weight, he had lost some hair, and then he kind of took us through his journey of the different bodies that he's had through his life. And it's so clear. It might not be as clear to people, because I don't think it was as clear to me when I was in my 20s, because you're still kind of like in your young body. As you have a few decades of life under your belt, I think you start to see your body change, and then you remember your parents at a certain age. Like, I remember my mother being 40, and me thinking, when I turned 40, I thought, oh, wow, I remember my mother as 40. And my son will remember me as 40. So that was an interesting moment for me to kind of make those connections. But if you have a few decades of life under you, you've definitely seen your body change. You have seen the mind change over time. Like, I've changed my mind so many times. I've resolved some issues, and obviously there are other issues that still need to be resolved. But, like, you've seen yourself change. And so what Krishna is saying in the Bhagavad Gita is, he's saying, hey, that's no different than when you die. You're just going to get a new type of body. I liked it. I really liked it because it was like, I didn't feel like I just had this one life to do, to accomplish everything that I had to accomplish. took some of the pressure off all of a sudden. Okay, wait, hold on. I get to do this again? That's kind of like what I was like mulling over in my mind. So the Sanskrit is very beautiful. Tehino sminyata dehi. And that means of the embodied, as in this body. Dehi. Komaram yomaram jara. Childhood, youth, old age. Teha deha tera pratir. So acquisition of another body. So you are embodied, as in this body, and you've experienced childhood, youth, and age. So, also, tata, deha tera pratir. So, also, you will acquire another body. Deras tata na muyati. The wise one in this is not deluded. It's beautiful. Like, so if I'm truly wise and I can understand this, I'm not going to be upset. So then the next one, physical sensation, truly Arjuna, causing cold, heat, pleasure and pain, come and go, as if summer and winter. They are impermanent. So manage to endure them, Arjuna. Matra parsa tukunteya. So material sensation. Truly, O son of Kunti. Tukunte, the Kunti, son of Kunti. Sitoshna sukha dukada. Cold, heat, pleasure, and pain. So cold, heat, right? So the winter and the summer. Sukha dukkha. Sukha dukkha. Sukha is like pleasure, and dukkha is like pain. You see that du, the word du, is like an axle hole that on a wheel that is not quite round. So the analogy I often give is like the shopping cart that you get. I mean, I don't think they have these anymore, these problems, but I can remember being a kid and going to the grocery store with my mom and the shopping cart that had that wonky jacked up wheel that would kind of like it was like shake. Yeah, so that's dukkha. It's like not flowing smoothly. And then one time I asked this a swami, I said, what is the difference between sukha and ananda? So ananda is bliss. So for those of you who practice yoga, there's a pose called happy baby. And that happy baby pose, it's actually not happy baby. It's ananda balasana. It's blissful child. So you're like a blissful baby, right? It's different than a happy baby. And you're basically holding your feet and pulling your knees to your chest or out. And in this way, you're a happy baby, right? Ananda, though. Sukha is happy, and ananda is bliss. So I was like, what's the difference? And he said, sukha is something that you get from material pleasure. So something that is material. Ananda is the soul being satisfied. So bliss and ananda doesn't come from a material source. So I thought that was very interesting. That was an awesome just understanding of those two words being slightly different. So pleasure and pain, they're going to come and go, like the winter and summer seasons. And you just have to learn to endure them. I find that to be so just right on. I was talking to Hridayananda. He's a very learned scholar and amazing teacher. And I had a question about bhakti. And so, I mean, the question was very detailed, and I'm not going to get into the question right now. But his answer was so great in that when he answered me. It was like exactly like kind of this, the way Krishna's talking here. I'm just pulling it up right now because I don't want to misquote. So he says at the end of the email, he says, in general, if you avoid most complicated advice, you will do well. The truth is simple, and the process for approaching the truth is also simple. So I was asking a question about kind of a detailed bhakti practice, and he was kind of laying it out, kind of the truth is very simple. And I love straight wisdom like that, that is, it seems perennial, and it seems to always ring true, no matter what spiritual tradition you're a part of. But in this, it's basically, you're going to have pleasure and pain, and you have to endure them. You just endure them. You know, it's part of the job description, almost, of getting the human body. So as we go through the Bhagavad Gita, we'll explore other concepts. This concept of reincarnation is one that is kind of a tenet that you have to kind of, yeah, I mean, you don't have to do anything, but, you know, I mean, if you really want to get into the subject matter of how they're viewing yoga, this is one of the things that really a lot of the philosophy is based on. And this thing of identifying the soul, there was Eleanor Roosevelt, somebody asked her about reincarnation once, and she said, you know, I don't think it's any less crazy of an idea than me taking birth in this body, this time, in this life, that if I were to take birth in another body at another time. And I just think that it's just smart knowledge. It's just a smart way to think. If I'm here this time, it's no crazier, right, than it being then. The Greeks have an interesting way of saying it. They call it transmigration of the soul. And most Greek philosophers agreed with that concept, that the soul transmigrates into another body. Now, we might anthropomorphize that a little bit, because you might come back necessarily not as this human body. It might come back as a different type of being, or if the universe is as big as they say it is in science, then who knows what that body may look like, right? That body may be in a different set of chemical circumstances where we would need to have a different type of body. But the idea of life, of cognition, the movie Interstellar is an interesting example of that, where, you know, they travel to the another planet that's all water, but it's right by a black hole. So by it being so close to the black hole, they have 100-foot waves there, which is like, that's their norm, because the gravity is so intense there. But time is different on their planet. So the way they interact with time and gravity is very different because of its connection to the black hole, its proximity to the black hole. So if we use that and we're not like Earth-centric, like, okay, I'm definitely coming back to the Earth, you know, what if I come back somewhere else to the planet of just water, where gravity is different, time is different? The chemical makeup of the planet could be different. It's almost like our bodies are designed, after millions of years of evolution, that we're designed to be in this particular planet at this particular time. So, I mean, reincarnation, you could broaden that spectrum, because a lot of times we just think we're going to come back here. And it'd be interesting to see what some of the learned scholars think about that. Some of these are just my thoughts on the subject of reincarnation. So subscribe to the podcast if you like it. I really enjoy doing them. It's really one of my favorite things to do. So subscribe to the podcast and talk to you soon.